are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
Let me frickin' say this. The bar for treason is so high, there's nobody less treasonous than Don Jr. I mean, granted, part of that is because he's dumb.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, January 4th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Professor from the School of Public Affairs at University of Georgia, Cass Mood, on the far right in America. Also on the program today, Trump disbands the Voter Fraud Commission and hands its data to ICE. Meanwhile, Wolf has tapes, and his book publisher gets a cease and desist order from the president's lawyer. Jeff Sessions appoints interim U.S. attorneys, including Rudy Giuliani's law partner, to take over for Preet Bharara. And then rescinds the federal pot directive, which will threaten legal weed in states across the country. Meanwhile, in Iran, Revolutionary Guard quashes protests, and the Virginia House of Delegates will be settled with a coin toss today. Yes.
That's insane.
All that and more on today's program. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it's an early, a special early live edition today of the program, as it's a little bit cold.
It's like an actual snowstorm.
Big snowstorm.
I'm like, you usually never believe it. I'm like, because mostly when these things are predicted, they turn out to be nothing, but this is actually something.
Yeah. And so we wanted to get started quickly today so that we could make it home. I don't know. It's tough to know exactly what the weather's going to be. And also, want to welcome back in 2018, Jamie. Hello, Jamie. You're back.
Hi. It's good to be back.
What happened? You came in this week?
What do you mean? What happened?
We missed you. Oh, early in the week.
I missed being here. I really did.
We made a joke that you had the that Michael should not have given you the new employee training.
That's right. Speaking of which, I'm going to be gone soon. I don't have specific dates yet, but it's happening.
All right. So there's huge fallout. I mean, we covered part of this yesterday from this. Is it Michael Wolff, his book?
Michael Wolff.
And apparently, I want to say Donald Trump's attorneys, but I mean, it's the president of the United States, sent a cease and desist letter to both Michael Wolff and the book publisher demanding they stop publication of the book.
This was Mark E. Salamode.
And issue
business.
An apology for defamatory statements made so far. Now, look, this doesn't mean anything. Other than it depends on how the rest of the government reacts to this. This is full on fascistic. The president of the United States cannot insist upon the cease and the desisting of a publication of a book. There is no defamation here. You just can't do that as the president of the United States. And it really is a function of what the rest of the government does as to, you know, how problematic this is going to be. Meanwhile, Anthony Scaramucci, who now sees an opening in the White House that seems to be fairly big.
Bring him back, please.
Is on George Stephanopoulos' show. And it's also, you can sort of contemplate this. It's sort of shocking in a way, right? Like, The guy was in the White House for 8 days, and yet he's on like the network show as a, I guess theoretically as a spokesperson. I don't know what it is, as a commentator. But here he is defending Donald Trump Jr.
The treasonous comment is absolutely ridiculous. If Steve said that, he should get on the air. He should come on your show today and take it back, because there's nobody less treasonous than Don Jr. There's nobody more patriotic. Perhaps the president
Pause
is more
Pause it for one second. I want you to just contemplate the way he frames this. There's nobody less treasonous. Not he's not treasonous at all. It's just that relative to the context he's in, there's nobody less treasonous.
George, you and I are both people. We're men of the fucking world. Everybody here has got a little bit of treason in them. That little fucking moron has the least treason in a treasonous environment, partially because, as you said earlier, he's a moron.
He's dumb. He's dumb.
How smart? Look, in order to
We got people in the White House who are selling nuke ideas, material to the Chinese.
If you knew half of the treason in this fucking White House, oh my
believe
God.
Believe me, he's the least of the treason.
Believe me, the kid's an idiot. He wants to cut up elephants in Africa, for God's sake. He's not your problem.
He'll shoot himself in the face, but he's not a treasonous as the other people there.
He's the endangered's problem, but not yours.
Let's keep
going. Don Jr., there's nobody more patriotic. Perhaps the president is more patriotic than Don Jr., but that's about it.
But was it smart to be meeting with Russians in Trump Tower?
So I didn't go to that meeting, and so I don't know all of the details related to the meeting. But to say somebody is treasonous and doing something against the interests of the United States because they took a meeting is absolutely ridiculous. You're not going to meet a more honest person than Don Jr.
So here he is both saying simultaneously, I'm convinced that he's not guilty of what he's accused of, but I actually know nothing about it, and I want to make it clear that I was in no way associated with that moment at the meeting.
It's just blue sky scenario here. I think the little prick did nothing. His father's the best person in the world, and I wasn't involved. Is that clear enough, George?
All right, look, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, a pre-recorded interview I did with Cass Mood, professor at University of Georgia, on his book, The Far Right in America. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Cass Mood. He is an associate professor at the School of Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia. He is the author of several books on the far right, both in the United States and in Europe. His most recent, The Far Right in America. Welcome to the program, Cass.
Thank you for having me.
So, okay, let's... I'm interested in your perspective, obviously, because this is something you study, but also as someone who is not American, and the perspective you bring from the far right in Europe, and be able to compare and contrast that with the United States. But let's just start with, in the context of the United States and also in Europe, give me a sense of what constitutes the far right.
Well, the far right is a pretty broad term that is generally used for pretty much all the movements on the right, and that is broadly defined as groups that believe that inequalities in society are natural and should not be overcome by state interference, and that are either hostile to democracy as such or to liberal democracy.
And so, I mean, is this on a spectrum, or do you basically, is that a type? And when we say far right, obviously it's sort of, it's relative, right, I guess, to the right, but we're talking about a unique set of principles. So give me a sense of any type of difference between what we see in the European far right and the American far right, and has that difference always been there, or the absence of that difference always been there, or is this a recent phenomenon?
Well, I would say that there are some aspects that are different. Most importantly, in the post-war period, The U.S. Far right has still been very much focused on the concept of race and racial differences, whereas that has become pretty much unacceptable in post-Holocaust Europe, where people speak more about cultures. In terms of organizations, the far right in the U.S. has always been relatively marginal and in small groups rather than in political parties, whereas particularly since the 1980s, Europe has seen a lot of radical right parties. And that, of course, has to do with the dominance of the two-party system in the U.S.
And so in Europe, is when you say that race in the post-war period is much more, I guess, taboo, or far less the far right is far less likely to reference race, is when they reference culture, is it simply just a proxy? I mean, is that a stylistic difference, or is there a substantive difference there?
There's both. Particularly in the early period, I would say it was mostly style. It had to do with much stricter anti-discrimination legislation, and so it was just illegal to speak about racial differences, particularly in negative term. But there is also an issue that the white race as such doesn't divide between different nationalities, and in the end, most nationalists, like most on the far right, are nationalist, and so they are Dutch, or they are German, or they are French, and race doesn't distinguish between these categories. So the prime marker of identity was ethnic, cultural, rather than racial, and this was even more the case because, to a certain extent, non-white immigration was relatively limited in Europe until, I would say, the 1980s.
I see. And so, so let's cross the Atlantic, and we see in the United States the growth of the far right. I want to catch up to where we see someone like Steve Bannon talking about a civic nationalism, which in some respects seems to echo what you're talking about in Europe, where they identified based upon their national heritage as opposed to a racial or, you know, a culture as a proxy for a racial heritage. But before we get there, I mean, where in your estimation are what we seeing today in terms of the far right? Are we seeing a continuation? How is the far right today different than, let's say, it was in 1980?
That's not so easy. The most important difference, of course, is that it has been mainstreamed. It is now operating within both the Republican Party and the broader conservative movement, where in the 1980s it used to be much more at the fringes. That said, at an ideological level, a lot of what the groups that we now talk about on the far right existed in the 1980s, of course, all kind of neo-Confederate groups, neo-Nazis, militias, and sovereign citizens. I think the Bannon argument, the Bannon vision of Western civilization, is a more new phenomenon and then very much linked to the terrorist attacks of 9/11.
And in your book here, now it's an assembly of essays, but there's a lot of concentration on the Tea Party. Tell us about what you call the Tea Party paradox, and why the Tea Party is you feel plays such an important role in this notion of the far right in the United States.
Well, so one of the remarkable things I think about the coverage of the rise of Donald Trump is the almost complete the absence of the story of the Tea Party, which was pretty much the big story of the rise of the right less than 10 years ago. And I think there are two explanations for that absence, first, Donald Trump didn't play any role in the Tea Party, and at that point in time probably still self-identified more as a Democrat than a Republican. And second, particularly in the liberal media and among liberal observers, the Tea Party has always been kind of written off as an astroturf organization, bankrolled by the Koch brothers and kind of like trumpeted by Fox News, but not with a real authentic base. But if you actually went to Tea Party rallies, as I did in Indiana in during that period, what you saw was a true grassroots movement, which by and large discussed the same issues as the Trump campaign did. It was about immigration. It was about the liberal elite. It was about Muslims and Islamophobia.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, because my perspective on the Tea Party was that its political salience was financed largely by outside groups, but that its base existed as essentially the base of the Republican Party. That there was no delineation in the anti-immigration feelings of people who go to a Tea Party rally any more than there was with the Republican Party, who in 2005 rejected George Bush's attempts to pass immigration reform, right? Like, I mean, these people were there. Were they not? Or, I mean, weren't they just the Republican base in 2004?
Yeah, and so what I argue in the book to a large extent is that both the Tea Party and Trump are creations of the GOP establishment, which started with the infamous Southern Strategy that tried to get white Democratic voters in the South to the Republican Party pretty much by racist dog whistling, and that over decades radicalized its discourse and its rhetoric, but in the end didn't deliver. And so there was a growing gap between the discourse of the Republican leadership and the policies that they actually implemented. And that created from within the Republican base a kind of a radicalized base that said, okay, so we are the real Republican Party. We follow what you all the time say, and you don't do what you say. And so we're looking now for real people. And those were first the Tea Party politicians who then, for example, shut down the government, as the GOP had said over and over again they were going to do, but never did. And so then people like Mike Lee and Ted Cruz came in. And the next step, which is more on the racial part and that type of policy, is Donald Trump, who, of course, most of his policies are broader endorsed within the GOP, both at the elite level, at least in discourse, but definitely at the base level.
And so, I mean, maybe this is a more general question, but when we're talking about movements like this, right, I mean, it's one thing for these groups of people to have these positions and these attitudes, but for their ascendancy, for their being reflected in the lawmakers that they elect, either because these lawmakers are true believers or they feel it necessary to pose as true believers because this is where the electoral base of the party has come from. To what extent, and this, like I say, this could be a generic question, but how much is it reliant on that type of funding? Because, you know, I mean, there's no analog on the left to have the type of infrastructure the Tea Party had in its rise. And maybe this is part of the problem that the Republican Party ended up having, was that you had, you know, for every a person out there who was saying, you know, the Affordable Care Act shouldn't be 100 pages long, or, you know, Barack Obama is not an American citizen, there was a Mark Levin, a Laura Ingraham, a Glenn Beck. There was the AFP spending money on buses and infrastructure and hiring professionalized Tea Party people. I mean, how much did that increase its power, I guess?
I think it was fundamental. But there is an explanation partly for why right-wing money was more effective than left-wing money. And this is in part when you're in opposition. And in the 1970s, but mostly 80s and early 90s, liberalism, particularly defined in the U.S., which is pro-economic integration and pro-multicultural integration, was pretty much hegemonic. And much of the resources went to maintaining the system, whereas the right, and particularly first neoconservatism and then kind of the broader, I would say, radical right, mobilized against that and targeted much clearer organizations. But the other thing is that whereas the right, at least since the 1980s, has always invested a lot in grassroots politics, including at the local and state level, which goes back to the Christian right, but also neoconservatism, the left hasn't. And you see that most dramatically in the 2016 election, where you had a mass movement around Bernie Sanders, which was to a large extent grassroots, but which completely fell apart as soon as Bernie Sanders was not the candidate for the presidential election, because the only thing they focused on was on winning the presidentship, whereas the right has a much broader agenda, and that helps it sustain and it helps its influence, which is phenomenal.
Walk me through how the broader agenda translates into the sustenance of the organization.
Well,
is that a funding? I mean, in other words, you know, when Bernie Sanders goes away, right, there's no more money to be raised for him as a presidential candidate. Whereas on the right, the funds are coming. I mean, the money is coming from just many more directions. There's just more bigger players, essentially.
Yes, there are. On the other hand, I mean, Donald Trump spent much less than Marco Rubio or Ted Cruz, and then Clinton, right? And many of the Tea Party movements were local grassroots, with really like nickel and dime operations, but what they profited from was the AFP, which gave webinars, for example. Mm. Again, there one of the things is that there was a much better connection between the grassroots and, let's say, AstroTurf than generally on the left, which has become, first of all, pretty much coastal and devoid of local politics and state politics, particularly outside of their strongholds. And when you talk about right-wing politics, for example, you don't talk about the presidentship so much. Like, one of the reasons why people like Ralph Reed supported the President Trump is because it was about judges, Supreme Court judges. They're very right. active on school boards. Like, they pretty much have politicized everything, which means that many of these things, which have big consequences, like school boards, you don't need a big budget for. You don't actually need a big budget to win court elections, like judge elections at local or state levels. So they have a lot of money, but they spend it much broader and therefore win much broader.
Interesting. So, all right, let's... Let's go. I mean, is there, so how does the Tea Party, I mean, walk us through this notion. I mean, the Tea Party was so prominent, and then it seemed like within the context, like within the span of, I don't know, 12 months, 18 months, 6 months, it seemed to have completely disappeared as an organizing principle. I mean, obviously the people are still there. The issue sets are there. But, it was as if one day you had the multitudes identifying themselves as part of the Tea Party movement. And then literally, same time next year, nobody.
Yeah. And I don't want to be overly populist here, but I think this is in part a consequence of an exclusive focus at the federal level, as well as kind of at the coastal level, because the Tea Party hadn't fully disappeared from Indiana politics or from Georgia politics. When we had the anti-immigrant legislation that started out in Arizona and was then adopted in various states, including Alabama and Georgia, the local Tea Parties played a major role. But it was no longer the AFP-sponsored and Glenn Beck, like, advertised, like, Tea Party.
Right.
It was now a local embedded and grounded groups. And that was mostly within the Midwest and the South. But they were still relevant there. Not anymore that national presence, but they were still mobilized. And probably many of them just now mobilized within the Republican Party, most notably, of course, through the primary system.
So there's an analog there in terms of, let's say, people coming out of the Occupy movement, going into places like the Bernie Sanders campaign or in other sort of, I guess, community organizations. They don't necessarily directly identify, or they just localize their work. So where is the Tea Party now? I mean, is the Tea Party still active? Has it been subsumed by, Trump Inc.? Where is it now?
Yeah, I think that what you saw when the Tea Party kind of emerged was that various groups that before that called themselves patriot groups, which were kind of an outflow of the modernization of the militia movements of the 90s, like there is some kind of a base, kind of constant base at grassroots levels of activists, which are not exactly the same, but which are a similar type of group, which have been active for a long time and which come up under different headers in different periods. At this point in time, I would imagine that most of the Tea Party groups are no longer using Tea Party labels and are particularly attracted to Trump, much more than the Republican Party. And so what they are doing is they are mobilizing for local and regional candidates that are, to a certain extent, exactly the same type of candidates that they argued for under during the Tea Party, which still attack the so-called rhinos, the Republicans in name only, but now they also have kind of a positive connotation in the sense of that they are part of the Trump train.
Well, give me a sense of where these folk lie on the sort of taxonomy of the far right. Like, where, how big of a role is, say, the folks who marched at Charlottesville? Like, where do they, give us a sense of sort of where they are on the continuum relative to the former Tea Partiers and the Trumpistas, if you will. Like, just give me a sense of who's in that spectrum and who's going to stay on that Trump train, I guess, going forward.
Yeah, so there's all kind of unfortunate terms going around at the moment. And so one is the old right, and another one is the old light. And so the main distinction between the old right, where we have to think about Richard Spencer and pretty much the people who marched in Charlottesville, those are the people that mobilize around race. Be they neo-Nazis or neo-Confederates or what is now called identitarians, but these are mostly people who are either white nationalists or white supremacists. They're still very marginal. They're marginal in terms of numbers, as even Charlottesville showed, because at best that was 1,500 people, and who came from almost the whole country. It's a country of 320 million, so that's relatively small. But they're also very marginalized. They don't have clear connections to the White House or even really to Breitbart. Now, the so-called old light are the people who are defending, saying they defend Western civilization. And so they have gone from race to civilization. It's not to say that there isn't some level of white supremacy in it. The way that they define Western civilization has, of course, is very European-centric and white-centric, but they are open to non-whites, and their main enemy is not so much the non-white, it is Muslims in particular, and their alleged like left-wing helpers, the so-called cultural Marxists, and whatever the term is. That is the group where Bannon fits, and that has the strongest voice in Breitbart, and they are clearly connected to the White House, and the people that support Trump fall much more in that category, although they are, of course, much less ideological than people like Steve Bannon.
Okay, so, and that's the alt-light.
That is the alt-light, but that really better is the term radical right.
Radical right. Okay, as opposed to the alt-right, who are basically
more extreme
on the
right.
White supremacist spectrum.
And they tend not to support democracy. Whereas the radical right does support democracy, does believe that the people should elect its leaders, but they don't think that every minority should have its right, most notably Muslims.
So the people should elect their leaders, but we get to choose who the people are.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, is that a how important of a distinction is that? I mean, what is the, obviously, look, we can't get inside of Steve Bannon's head, and God help us if we could. I don't know that would be a very comfortable place to be for very long.
No.
But I mean, what is the relevance of that difference? Or is it simply, to have some specificity? Because, I guess I believe Steve Bannon when he says, like, I'm okay with you if you have Mexican heritage, if you are already here and a legal citizen. I don't know that I believe him. I mean, if we see, like, what kind of policies come out of this administration, maybe I'm giving him too much credit for having control of the policies. But when you look at the policies that are coming out of this administration, it's not just a question of, like, there is, it seems to me when you come out and you say merit-based immigration, right?
Mm-hmm.
That there is, it is impossible for you to sit there and say, I'm for merit-based immigration, and I certainly expect that we're going to be letting in as many, let's say, people from Mexico or from Guatemala or from El Salvador as we will from, let's say, Denmark. I think to say that and to be a relatively intelligent person, enough so that you could, tie your shoes and write this order, that you'd have to be lying to yourself, because what you're saying from a merit standpoint is, people in Mexico or El Salvador who have these higher degrees may very well want to stay in that country and help, build their country up, whereas there may be more competition for someone like that in, let's say, Denmark. And so you get a sense of who's going to end up immigrating.
For sure. And to a large extent, like, of course, merit is always defined by the dominant culture.
Right.
And so in that sense, there, obviously there's discrimination, but there is a major difference between a white nationalist, which by and large just wants all the non-whites out of the country, or a white supremacist, which allows them to be in the country but doesn't give them rights, and someone who by and large allows people in the country and rights but puts them a little bit lower, doesn't give them all the same protection. And so the difference is not necessarily so big for whites, but I think it is very significant for non-whites. Like in the viewpoint of Steve Bannon, a non-European in a sense can assimilate into a European culture. In Richard Spencer's view, a non-white can never become a white, right? And so while neither of them are liberal democratic and are for what I stand, I do think it's a very significant difference, as is whether you support democracy or not, because in Bannon's world, you can still vote Bannon out. In Richard Spencer's world, there are no elections.
I see. And that, and I think your point's well taken. If you are a victim of, if you're on the other side of this, if you're not white, it makes a big difference, because it may mean the difference between you being able to stay here with your family or not, or being able to at least vote. Yeah, I mean, that point taken. So this alt-light, give me a sense of how wide a range that is. We have Steve Bannon. Who else are figures in this alt-light to give us a sense of who they are?
Well, a lot of this movement is social media related, and so you would count people like Mike Cernovich, like bloggers like that, to it. But to a certain extent, that type of radical right ideology is also supported by Congress members like Steve King,
right,
of Iowa, or Dana Rohrabacher in California, before Michelle Bachmann, Louis Gohmert. It's always been around. There are various groups that are close to it, but Jeff Sessions is, who of course has a bit more of a racial discourse because he's from the South, but people like him, like Chris Kobach, the Stephen Miller, these are all part of, they all share largely a similar type of radical right ideology without necessarily being part of one integrated organization.
And we should say that we're making a distinction here. Steve Bannon could very well be just as racist in some way, right? I guess as a Richard Spencer. It's just that his political program is different.
Yes, I mean, you can't look in the hat of anyone. I mean,
right,
maybe Richard
course.
Spencer is
right.
actually not a racist. He
right.
just like has profiled himself like that. But as a political figure, Steve Bannon doesn't mobilize around race and about racial superiority.
Okay. All right. Good. And that's an important distinction to make there. So okay. So with that said, what is the I understand the implications of people who are on the receiving end, in particular, who are most vulnerable to these differences. From a political standpoint, what is the difference there? It's when we approach, if Donald Trump's base is the alt-light, right?
Mm-hmm.
And may very well be racist, but in terms of programmatically, they still convince themselves that, like, no, I have Mexican friends, but I like the good ones, not the
right.
The ones who are
exactly.
the ones who are, who have the restaurant down the road. I was really surprised to see him get deported, that type of thing. How is that helpful in terms of those people who want to whose project it is to diminish the power of these people in our country?
Well, when you look at the ideology of, like, the radical right, or, like, in these terms, alt-light, what you will see is that they're actually not fundamentally different from a lot of mainstream values, and particularly of values of the conservatives and of the Republican Party. And they're in the U.S., for example, there has been, from the beginning, an aspect of white supremacy, which has become less open and less legalized. But there are still, of course, massive, at the very least, white privilege. Aspects of authoritarianism, where you by and large see everything as a law and order issue. So, for example, drugs is not an issue of healthcare, but it's an issue of punishment. Has a long tradition within conservatives and within the Republican Party. And even many aspects of the populism, and particularly of anti-establishment sentiments and this idea that there is some kind of liberal elite at the coasts, is something that the radical right of people like Bannon have in a more in a more extreme version than the mainstream has, but the mainstream has it as well, and that's why it can be so successful. Whereas Richard Spencer's ideas are much more at odds with some of those ideas of what America is.
Right, and I think it's also just much more uncomfortable to walk around with that belief system and sort of embrace it for if you're an American. All right, well, tell us about the five stages of liberal denial, like what and how we're thinking about populism in the wrong way.
Okay, well, so I think with regard to how we think about populism in the wrong way, let me start with that. I think that the term populism is being used increasingly for nativism. And so in nativism, you want your country to be pretty much of the own people, the natives, and you think anyone who is non-native or alien is a threat. And so this is about issues of immigrations, and here the other is, to a certain extent, the ethnic other. In populism, the distinction is within the own people, within the own ethnic group, and it's a distinction on the basis of morality, the elite, which is corrupt, and the people that are pure. And if you look at the agenda, and particularly the policies of, for example, Donald Trump, but you see to a certain extent the same of right-wing governments in Europe, it's not so much the populism that is implemented, it is the nativism. Like the wall is not about populism, it's not to keep the corrupt elite out, it is to keep the Mexicans out. The drain the swamp is about populism.
Mm.
And so, the other thing is that both Brexit in Britain and Trump are not pure elections of populism. What Trump got elected first and foremost because he was the leader of one of the two big parties. And there were a lot of people who voted now for Trump, but they would have voted for Cruz or for Rubio. They would have voted for any leader of the Republican Party. So they didn't specifically look for his populist or populist radical right agenda. On the other hand, they were also not appalled by it enough to say we're not voting for it. So I think it's what we often do is we equate the vote for Trump to the vote for, let's say, Marine Le Pen of the Front National in France, but it's different because when you were on the right in the U.S., you only had one choice. You could either vote for Trump or you had to vote for someone on the left. And so a lot of people voted Republican rather than Trump. So on the one hand, we see too much populism by saying that everyone who voted for Trump is a populist. And on the other hand, and we see too much populism because a lot of what we call populism really is nativism, is about ethnicity.
So we see more populism than is there, is what you're saying. And we read into certain things that... right, and then I think, frankly, that's interesting because I think the Tea Party there was this notion that it was about fiscal discipline, and
right.
I think which is a laughable claim, and it was laughable at that time. I mean, the guy who stood on the in the commodities floor was not a Tea Partier, and announced are you sick of this stuff or whatever. Those were all commodities traders. So what are the five stages of liberal denial that we that is important for us to be aware of?
Yeah, and so I kind of noted that during 2016 and particularly Trump election, but to a certain extent also Brexit. And in the first phase, we have mockery, and so the populist kind of comes up, or the outsider comes up, and we just mock them because we think they don't stand a chance. But then when they become a bit more relevant, we're getting outraged. And at that point in time, we still kind of believe that the populace is not really going to win, but we're getting kind of outraged about the fact that they have such a platform and such support. Then once the populace wins, or the radical right wins, we get into denial or disbelief. And by and large, it's the stage where you say, well, it wasn't really Trumpism that won, right? People didn't really vote for his agenda. They were just upset about Clinton.
Right.
And so what we by and large try to do is whitewash the voters and say, well, but we also just whitewash ourselves, our own society, and say, well, this is like not who we are. Like what's here in the U.S. was often said, this is not America. Then we get into the conspiracies where there was some kind of conspiracy that turned the election result in the U.S. Of course, it's the Russia conspiracy.
Right.
There is no argument that Russia interfered. There is no evidence so far that in any way swung the election. But the conspiracy still means that you don't actually accept that they won. The argument is that it is impossible in a country like the U.S. that someone can win on a nativist, authoritarian, and populist platform, which is problematic. And then there's democratic denial in the sense that pretty much the democratic legitimacy of the populist is being denied. And so in Britain, for example, there was a call for a second referendum. And here in the U.S., there's in part this argument that he isn't really democratically elected because of the Electoral College, which is of course factually true, but the Electoral College was not an issue before he was elected.
Right.
And the problem with all of this is that it by and large denies the popular basis of support for the populist radical right. And I don't argue that the majority of Americans or Brits or French or whatever hold populist radical right values. However, what we do see is that a bit more moderate interpretation of similar attitudes are very wide shared. There's a large plurality of Americans that believe that there are too many immigrants. Islamophobia is very widespread, not just within conservative circles. Authoritarianism, as well as the view that poor people are poor because they don't work hard, like all these kind of values are much broader shared than is often acknowledged.
And I guess the lesson is that at least some of those issue sets need to be addressed or pushed back upon or dealt with in some fashion because this broader alt-light and its fellow travelers movement is not going anywhere.
No, exactly. And so we focus way too much on, like, now we have this kind of theory that Trump was just kind of a weird freak show that like came out of nowhere together with the genius of Steve Bannon that kind of manipulated the people into this and that. It again kind of like whitewashes history and society because the U.S. has a very, very long history of nativist politics going back to the mid-19th century. It has a very long tradition of authoritarian politics, which think about the war on drugs or many others,
right.
And it has a very long tradition of anti-government and anti-establishment sentiments. So if you look at that just in a historical context, the whole Trump phenomenon is not that remarkable. It's remarkable that he wins, but it's not remarkable that agenda itself has broad support.
Indeed. Cass Mudd, associate professor of the School of Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia. The book is The Far Right in America. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, head to the fun half. Just a reminder, you can support this program by becoming a member. at jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. We get something like 90. We haven't run the numbers lately because of one of our computers is down. But we get something like 94.37% of our revenue comes from folks like you who enjoy the show on a daily or thrice weekly basis and then become members at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off all that good coffee. Check out the Michael Brooks Show. You can find it on our YouTube page, or you can sign up even better through iTunes to listen to it as a podcast, or head to his Patreon page to upgrade your experience to a premium experience.
That's right.
All right, we're going to head into fun FAF 646-257-3920. Got a lot of excerpts from this book that, they're funny to read, and it validates a lot of things that we've been saying about Donald Trump. But I also think that there's something to glean here in terms of what we can anticipate ultimately will be the array of crimes that people in the administration will be guilty of. And we will talk a little bit about that. Also, there's two or three big developments, I think, that are going to impact people's lives from a policy standpoint. Obviously, the disbanding of the Voter Fraud Commission, but the handing over of this portfolio to ICE in the Department of Homeland Security is a little bit scary. There's going to be lawsuits. Also, the move by Sessions and Trump, both in terms of pot and in terms of who they're appointing for U.S. attorneys, very important. And then some good news, which again shows the relevance of judicial appointments in this country. And we'll also play a video from Tucker Carlson. So all that in the fun half. Be right back.